Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care workshop on pancreatic cancer treatment update. And today's program is supported or made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and supported by a grant from Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals, Inc. as well. And I want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have just wonderful people on the program today, both wonderful speakers, but we also have a lot of participants on the call. We have over 200 participants on today's program. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from the United Kingdom and from Canada. So it's a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly. And Dr. O'Reilly is the Winthrop Rockefeller Endowed Chair in Medical Oncology, Section Head, Hepato, Pancreobiliary, and Neuroendocrine Cancers, Co-Director, Medical Initiatives, David M. Rubenstein Center for Pancreas Cancer, Chair, Human Research Protection Program and IRB, Attending Physician Member, Memorial Professor of Medicine while at Cornell Medical College. And Dr. O'Reilly will be addressing an overview of pancreatic cancer, including current standard of care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Reilly.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for the invitation, Carolyn, to speak today. And it's a pleasure to introduce the topic of pancreas cancer. And just a little bit of background for this disease, that this cancer is actually one that's increasing in incidence. We see two observations in this regard, that as we all get older, this cancer is more common, but where most of the change is actually in younger people, where the incidence is more sharply increasing, and reasons for that are unclear, but there's a lot of focus on this area, and some of these observations are in parallel with what's seen in other gastrointestinal cancers, such as colon and rectal and esophageal and gastric cancer. For pancreas cancer, for most people, we don't fully understand why it happens. In about 10 to 12% of people with this disease, there can be an underlying genetic predisposition, and it's recommended for each individual who's diagnosed with this cancer that they personally have genetic testing done to look for one of these alterations in their genetic makeup. And similarly, that we profile or characterize their cancer directly and see what the spectrum of genes there are. And some of my colleagues will be talking about this a little bit later as to how that information applies to new treatments for pancreas cancer. In general, we don't recommend routine screening for this disease because the overall population incidence of this cancer is very low. But in selected individuals who are carriers of some of these genes, for example, the BRCA genes or Lynch genes and some others, we do recommend that healthy individuals who carry those genes are enrolled on screening programs and as part of registries, where there's a lot of focus understanding whether there may be an impact from early detection in a group of individuals that may be deemed to be at higher risk. So moving now to the more clinical aspects of this disease, we divide pancreas cancer really into three groups, people who have localized and operable disease, people who have localized but inoperable disease, and then a majority of people who will be diagnosed will present with metastatic disease where the cancer has spread, and typically to the liver, inner lining of the abdominal cavity, lungs, and lymph nodes would be the common sites of metastasis. And one point to emphasize for the audience, this disease comes with a challenging reputation, but there are treatments that have been shown to impact both quality of life and length of life, and part of the goal is sort of tailoring the best treatment plan for the health and well-being of an individual. When the cancer is localized, we recommend initially for most people a chemotherapy-based treatment, and that can be with one of two major treatment programs, either FOLFIRINOX, which is a combination of oxaliplatin, 5-FU, leucovorin, and a drug called irinotecan. That acronym is FOLFIRINOX, and that's in guidelines and widely used in all settings of pancreas cancer. Another combination is with gemcitabine and a drug called nab-paclitaxel, and both of these combinations have been shown to have an ability to shrink the cancer, to control disease, and extend life. And again, both programs of treatment are used in every setting of this cancer. If the cancer is operable, approaches to go directly to surgery and then follow up with 6 months of post-operative treatment. That's called adjuvant treatment, and typically FOLFIRINOX, or maybe for individuals who are less robust, gemcitabine with or without an oral agent called capecitabine would be the standards. When it's localized but inoperable, initial chemotherapy followed by evaluation as part of a multidisciplinary assessment, and this is important in pancreas cancer, that for people with localized disease, we have an oncologic surgeon weighing in, a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, and other disciplines, because that discussion can help facilitate the best treatment planning for that individual. And always in the context of localized pancreas cancer, we're looking to see, you know, where and if a surgery might fit, recognizing that it's a percentage, maybe 10 to 20% of people with pancreas cancer, that over the course of their disease, there'll be room for surgery. So moving now to the metastatic disease setting, The goals are, again, maintaining best health for as long as possible. And in 2023, we saw the readout of a phase 3 study, which was examining a version of FOLFIRINOX called NALIRIFOX, which uses a different formulation of irinotecan, where there may be higher levels in the tumor. And that combination was compared to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, and showed that for an average person with this disease, that a FOLFIRINOX-based regimen, including NALIRIFOX, may be a preferred alternative to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. But would say that that's nuanced. It depends on a number of characteristics. It also depends on the genetic context and the health overall of the individual person. So both of these programs, FOLFIRINOX, its first cousin, NALIRIFOX, and gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, are the main treatment paradigms in the metastatic disease setting. For the subset of individuals that have a BRCA mutation, either in the blood or in the tumor, we'll recommend integrating a platinum drug, either as part of FOLFIRINOX or NALIRIFOX, or cisplatin and gemcitabine as a standard treatment approach. There's a lot of data indicating that platinum drugs have particular benefits in this group of people with pancreas cancer, where we see sometimes greater degrees of cancer shrinkage and cancer control, and also as part of standard therapy in this patient population with BRCA1 or BRCA2, is the use of PARP inhibitors. These are an oral class of drugs in a maintenance setting. And what that means is in the setting of metastatic pancreas cancer, after the disease has been controlled and stabilized, we're always hoping to de-escalate therapy to reduce the treatment intensity, to improve quality of life, and to allow flexibility in other regards. And an oral PARP inhibitor, olaparib, is an FDA-approved drug that may be used in this setting, and that's overall a well-tolerated medication that can contribute to cancer control in this setting. So all of what we've discussed so far is within the realm of standard treatment. Sort of bridging between standard and where the field is going is profiling the individual tumor and defining the genetic context of a particular person's disease. And up until now, a majority of patients we know that will find a KRAS mutation in the tumor. And that is something that previously was considered to be a common finding in pancreas cancer, but not one that could be directly impacted. There are a number of drugs in the clinic, and again, my colleagues will speak more about this, but we know that there's a subset of people who don't have a KRAS mutation, and we do find relatively rare other genetic findings, these may be called fusions, et cetera, that are present in the tumor for which there are drugs that are in standard guidelines that may be applicable to a percentage of people. So, you know, once again, we think it's very important for an individual to have comprehensive genetic testing for the bloodline, looking at predisposition and learning about implications for that individual and their family, but also to profile the tumor to get any clues that we can there with regard to non-chemotherapy-based approaches. And, you know, as we're getting into this era now of being able to target more broadly the more common mutations of pancreas cancer, in particular here KRAS, this is an extremely important topic. I'll mention one last thing before closing related to how standard therapies are evolving. And this, you know, has a little bit of controversy as I bring it up in 2024, but our hope is that we're going to be moving more in this direction. For selected people who have metastatic pancreas cancer where their cancer responds well to treatment, we're always looking, are there other approaches that can be integrated as part of the treatment plan? So, for example, might radiation have a role? Might ablation or targeting a tumor that is a metastasis beyond chemotherapy, might there be value in doing that? And there's some early data to suggest that in selected people that this is going to be an important area to study rigorously to define new paradigms in terms of how we approach pancreas cancer. So thank you very much. I will pass it back here to Dr. Messner and look forward to hearing the rest of the program today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Reilly. That was just a wonderful, comprehensive presentation. And I have to say that as the first speaker, you've kind of set the stage for today's program. So thank you so much. Thank you. And our, I'm going to move on to our next speaker. And And our next speaker is Dr. Paul Oberstein. Dr. Oberstein is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, Assistant Director, Pancreas Cancer Center, Director, Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology Program NYU Langone Cancer Center. And Dr. Oberstein is going to be addressing new and emerging treatment approaches, including clinical trials. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Oberstein.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me and for having me on this program. My name is Paul Oberstein, and it's really a great honor to be able to present in a few minutes some information about new and emerging treatment approaches in pancreatic cancer. First thing I would say is to sort of build on what Dr. O'Reilly just mentioned. There is a lot of excitement about what's coming down the road, what treatment options will be available and will expand. There are many things that still need to be tested in clinical trials, so we are, of course, optimistic and encourage clinical trial participation whenever possible. I would start by pointing out that, as Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, there was, for the first time in over a decade, a new drug approved in the first-line setting of pancreatic cancer for patients with advanced disease. And this drug was approved this year. It's a cousin of a previous drug that we were using, so a combination regimen called NALIRIFOX, which was very similar to FOLFIRINOX, which had previously been widely used and remains widely used. Some of the very exciting thing about the study that led to approval of NALIRIFOX really related more to side effects and tolerability of the drug. And essentially what the study group did was they modified a previous regimen in a way that turned out to be significantly more tolerable than we had thought it was going to be. And that's really good news because it means that there are potentially more patients, people we wouldn't previously have thought of being able to tolerate aggressive multi-agent chemotherapy, who probably could handle it in these modified doses. And this becomes an option for more and more patients to receive treatment that hopefully will help improve their outcomes. So that's a new regimen. We're still learning how to incorporate it with the previous regimens that were previously used that Dr. O'Reilly discussed, but it does definitely add to our armamentarium. Going forward, and I want to focus the rest of my time on new and emerging treatments, there is hope that we are finally learning enough about pancreatic cancer so that we can be more specific when we treat it and think of it not as one disease, but as having subtypes of pancreatic cancer based on tumor features. This is still not in practice, it's still in clinical trials, but the hope is that as we learn more and more about how to analyze and subset tumors, we can customize therapy and give the right chemo or the right treatment to a particular type of tumor, potentially with greater efficacy and fewer side effects. Again, this is in clinical trials, and there's different ways to look at these tumors, but our hope is that as we learn more and more about tumors and test more tumors and analyze them, we'll be able to learn more about which treatment might be ideal for which patient. And as I said, there are clinical trials that are evaluating that specifically. Beyond that, what Dr. O'Reilly also mentioned is that there has been a great effort to encourage patients to have their tumors sequenced. And that means to understand which genetic mutations and other alterations are present in the tumor. And the potential benefit of that is that beyond subtypes of tumor, there are some specific alterations that can be targeted with specific therapies. And there are multiple clinical trials looking at targets, many different kinds, what are called antibody-drug conjugates or direct antibodies or other methods to target specific elements or mutations or alterations in pancreatic cancer. The most frequent alteration is KRAS gene mutations, which are present in probably 90 to 95% of all patients. And there are multiple agents in clinical trials now that are specifically targeting different alterations in that mutation, in KRAS, in that gene, or throughout the whole gene, essentially. These agents are all in clinical trial. None are quite yet ready to be used broadly. There's one mutation that has a specific target that is FDA-approved, KRAS G12C, but approved in a different setting. But the much, much more common mutations are all things that we are pursuing and testing in trials. And I would say there's a lot of excitement about what these drugs may mean, but there's a lot left to learn about which patients are going to benefit and when to utilize them. And so these are really exciting trials that are ongoing. I'll mention two other things. In the last minute, I think. One is that we're also trying to, and have trials that are ongoing trying to evaluate the best way to sequence therapy in those who do not have metastatic disease. So patients who have localized disease, potentially at locally advanced disease, but these are people who cannot necessarily, who do not have metastatic disease, so it has not spread, and surgery may be part of their treatment or other targeted surgical procedures, as Dr. O'Reilly also mentioned. And the question of how to give chemo and which way to give chemo, do you do it before surgery, after surgery, or sandwiched, and what chemo to give are also things that are emerging in terms of clinical trials. There are ongoing trials that are evaluating some of these treatments. And our hope, of course, is to learn exactly which patient will benefit from treatment at which time. And finally, I would just want to mention that there's also a lot of interest in trying to understand how to prevent disease from coming back or to target minimal disease. So if someone has tumor that's removed or has treatment that's very effective and the disease seems to be under control, how do we maintain that? And so this is a question of what's called maintenance therapy or minimal residual disease therapy. And there are multiple approaches in clinical trials targeting that, including vaccines that may be very effective once we get the disease under control or remove the disease. And there are several trials looking at vaccines in that setting. Again, these are exciting future options that I hope will lead to changes in how we treat patients in the near future. As I started off, we always encourage patients to ask about clinical trials and to participate when feasible. So thank you very much for the opportunity, and I think I will pass it on now to my colleagues.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Oberstein. That was a wonderful presentation and certainly an excellent call out to the participation in clinical trials, how they really make a difference in advancing the treatment of all cancers. And so thank you so much for doing that as well. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Brandon Smaglow, and Dr. Smaglow is Associate Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal GI Medical Oncology, Division of Cancer Medicine, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Smaglow will be addressing practical tips to prevent and manage treatment side effects and symptoms. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Smaglow.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and pleasure to be with everyone today virtually. So thank you all for joining us. I hope this is a useful afternoon for you. I'm going to be talking about management of symptoms and side effects, and I think I want to just start off with some big picture considerations here, because the fact of the matter is that symptoms are likely present from a cancer as well. And unfortunately, a lot of the symptoms that pancreatic cancer can invoke really overlap with some of the symptoms that we might see with treatment for that cancer. And so, for example, very common symptoms that a cancer might cause could include things like fatigue, weight loss and loss of appetite, pain, and depending on impact on pancreatic function, diarrhea. Many of the treatments that we use, certainly the chemotherapies that my colleagues have been discussing thus far, can also lead to things like fatigue, nausea that could lead to weight loss and changes in appetite, and also other GI symptoms like diarrhea. And so I think it's important to stress that finding a good balance between the effects of the chemotherapy against the cancer or the treatment against the cancer and the side effects are leading to a better quality of life in addition to having good cancer control. Not perhaps intuitive, but very commonly what we do see is that by treating the cancer, we can have a fairly quick, you know, within a few rounds of treatment and a fairly meaningful improvement in addressing the symptoms that are related to the cancer. And so one of the things I would just start out by saying is that it's important to go into therapy. Of course, it's scary, and we're here to support folks with this, but understand that the therapy, yes, it's intended to control the cancer, and yes, it's intended to extend life, but it also is a very effective way to help improve quality of life and tamp down those cancer-related symptoms, and in most cases, the sort of investment of some symptom from the treatment is worth the price that you pay in terms of benefit. With that all being said, I do think that it's important to be cognizant of what an individual's symptoms are and how they perceive them, because that may impact their ability to continue with therapy. Certainly what the therapy is trying to achieve might influence how much toxicity from that therapy we would think is justifiable. And so, for example, with Dr. Oberstein and Dr. O'Reilly, we're talking about the different roles for chemotherapy. In an adjuvant setting where somebody has a surgery and the goal is to give chemotherapy for a pre-specified period of time as a part of a curative program, perhaps taking on a little bit more toxicity is acceptable compared to a situation where the goal of therapy is to be used in a more of an open-ended or an indefinite manner to control a cancer. That being said, what is acceptable really is going to be up to the patient and what they are the ones experiencing ultimately. And so the same degree of symptom that might be experienced by two different individuals might nonetheless be very differently tolerated and differently accepted. And so I think having that nuanced acknowledgement is really key to helping folks get through therapy. And so to that end, I think the most important thing is that when folks are on therapy, that they are a squeaky wheel. Yes, you told me that I was going to have nausea and neuropathy, but I didn't really realize what that meant. I didn't really realize it was going to be this bad. What can we do to improve those things? Now, candidly, sometimes there's not a lot we can do. For some symptoms, the only recourse may be to change the therapy or at least dose reduce the therapy that somebody is receiving. But if that's what's necessary for somebody to feel that they can continue with therapy, if it's what they want to do, it's not unreasonable. And so the point is that your symptoms in many cases and most cases are subjective. And so to just assume that this is how life has to be, I don't think is what any of us would want our patients to assume, and that folks should be really invested in their own self-interest as far as their symptoms go just as much as their cancer treatment goes. I do want to highlight a few points around some common symptoms in the few minutes I have left here. The first is that many symptoms have other treatment options. Commonly with chemotherapy and other treatments, we have a lot of GI distress, so that might be nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. And there are many different ways to manage these. And so we will always assume that somebody may have some of these symptoms and try and head them off. But that doesn't mean that just because we've used our first pass of therapy for these, that we're stuck without other options. And so if they are not responding to what we've done, patients should be working with their providers to find a better solution. Some other symptoms oftentimes can be addressed with what you might think of as non-conventional interventions. And I'll highlight neuropathy as an example here, because a lot of our therapies cause neuropathy, a sort of burning pins and needles sensation in the fingers and the toes. And frankly, the drugs that we have to manage neuropathy are not great. But other interventions such as, and I'll highlight one, acupuncture have shown to be effective in stemming these symptoms for a lot of our patients. And there's a whole host of other ways that we can approach these. And so the takeaway message that I'd say for all of this is just don't assume that your symptoms are acceptable just because they're what you're told you were going to have to have. Everything has some negotiation around it and probably even some other additional options to manage. And so let us know what you're experiencing, and in most cases we can find a common ground to keep you on good therapy, but also keep you with the best possible quality of life with that therapy. I'm going to pause there. Very nice to be able to talk to all of you for a few minutes today, and looking forward to any questions at the end of the discussion.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Smeglo. And I think your comment about being sure to let the healthcare team know about your quality of life and how you're really feeling and other options, that's really so important. So thank you for highlighting that as well in your presentation today. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you certainly during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Andrew Epstein. And Dr. Epstein is associate attending Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center Gastrointestinal Oncology Service Supportive Care Service. And Dr. Epstein is going to be addressing the role of the pain management and palliative care team in managing discomfort, pain, and quality of life. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Epstein.
Thanks so much, Carolyn, for having me and to all the panelists. I'm honored to be with you, and I think it's fitting to go after Dr. Smeglo, who had mentioned things that I like Carolyn, really agree with in terms of making sure that patients are empowered for them and their family to speak up and to make their concerns as well as their priorities known, because that's a lot about what I wanted to talk about today. I was given the topic of, as Carolyn said, the palliative care team in managing pain as well as other discomforts and quality of life. And the first thing I want to say is that the palliative care team is extraordinarily important to have access to, and at the same time, we should not conflate palliative care with a specific type of palliative care called hospice care. They are related but very, very different. Palliative care teams can and should work alongside the cancer care that patients and families are receiving, such as you've heard about today from medical oncology and surgical and radiation oncology teams. And so this should start from the very beginning. In fact, large bodies, including the NCCN, recommends that all cancer patients should be screened for palliative care needs at their initial visit and at appropriate intervals and as clinically indicated, and that patients and families should be informed of what I was saying, which is palliative care is part of comprehensive care. So it comes during, not after, cancer care. That's the first comment that I wanted to make. And regarding pain management, Dr. Smaglow had commented on some of this, so I don't want to go too much into pain or other symptom management, but I wholeheartedly agree that this illness, pancreas cancer, can come with pain and other symptoms from the disease as well as its treatment. So to not go into a lot of detail, pain being a common symptom must be addressed and communicated about. It exists across not only a bodily, but a spiritual and a psychological spectrum that clinicians need to ask patients about prior experiences with pain, concerns about pain. Some patients have concern about addiction to opiates, which are the most established way to treat moderate or severe cancer pain, but can come with side effects sometimes. So this needs to be an ongoing communication paradigm between patients and their clinicians to make sure that pain management is as best as possible. There are non-opiate treatments for pain that can be done, by the way, as I'll mention, either by the palliative care specialist team or the primary oncology team, may it be the medical, surgical, or radiation oncology team. But there are adjunctive pain therapies, either pharmacologic things beyond opiates or even procedures, whether it's a celiac plexus block or other specific procedures that sometimes are needed when opiates or other medicines are not working. But fortunately, medicines, after good communication about these things, can help patients to feel better with pain and other symptoms. And as Dr. Smaglow mentioned, the actual chemotherapy that's given when there's disease present can also help patients to feel better and improve other outcomes. So that is palliation in and of itself. To get to the word palliation, since I was given the assignment of discussing the palliative care team, just to be clear, again, palliative care is a specialty of medicine that helps patients and families cope and live better, longer lives with serious illness. Serious illness could be cancer or non-cancer illnesses, and so pancreas cancer, no matter what form it is, whether it's resectable or not, as Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, is a serious illness, and the palliative care team should be available to patients and families should patients want to have that additional layer of support while a cancer is being evaluated and treated. And most cancer centers have access to palliative care teams, which, like the primary medical, surgical, or radiation teams, are interdisciplinary. They have physicians, nursing professionals. They also have pharmacists, chaplains, social workers to help across the biopsychosocial spectrum to help patients navigate and have the best experience possible. Palliative care is not just treatment of symptoms, although that is a big thing. It's also helping patients to understand what's going on, to have good communication with their loved ones, if needed, to have good communication with their primary cancer teams. And as I think is very important, to understand who they are as people, meaning what are their health-related values? What are, as Dr. Smaglow said, the individualized priorities that is important for that patient to live as best as possible? And as was alluded, all people have individualized values and priorities. And those tend to endure over time. While the so-called goals of care and priorities in the moment can change depending on what's going on with an illness or what's going on with a treatment, values tend to endure, and therefore it is of utmost importance that patients and or families communicate with the clinical team what's most important to them, such as what are they hoping for? What are they concerned about? what are abilities that are so critical that they couldn't imagine living without them? And only through this can both symptoms and priorities on symptom and non-symptom levels be best understood by teams, primarily the medical oncology teams, which are so very important, as has been described in the treatment of pancreas cancer. There's a relationship between the clinicians and the patients and families, which is really something that I, as a medical oncologist, am always amazed by. And that relationship can be strengthened through this active, ongoing communication. I think that patients and families can do best by themselves to think about what's most important to them as people, to communicate that if it's not being asked about by the medical oncologists or other oncologists, and to prepare for appointments both before and during appointments if needed with written down questions. There will be questions about how to deal with patient portal results and looking at the clinician notes. There's access to support groups and other informational resources. I think patients should ask themselves what's the quality of informational resources that they see, and they should ask their oncology and palliative care teams about these things. And there's a lot that I can go on about, but this is something that I hope is helpful to understand: quality of life, symptom management, whether or not a specific specialty palliative care team is involved on top of the primary oncology team or teams. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Epstein. It's such an important area, and I think that I would hope that everyone on this call, if you don't have a supportive care team working with you, ask for them, because they really are, it's amazing. Because it's a multidisciplinary team, it consists of so many different disciplines looking at what can be done to help. It makes a very big difference. So thank you so much to Dr. Epstein. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian, the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she is a dietitian, and she will be addressing coping with weight loss, including eating and hydration tips and suggestions. It's my pleasure now to introduce to you my esteemed colleague, Ms. Diana Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So the main goal when we look at nutrition during your treatment with pancreas cancer is to reverse or prevent malnutrition. And we do this by meeting your hydration, calorie, and protein goals. Nutrition and hydration play an essential role in your tolerance to your treatment, completing your cancer therapies, and providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Your diet might be modified to assist with helping managing some of the side effects you may experience. Now, some potential side effects, we've heard some already today, but just to review, you might experience things like poor appetite, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, gas, bloating, and fatigue. During your course of treatment, your nutritional needs can change based on your tolerance to treatment or the type of treatment that you're receiving. If you're not able to meet your nutrition needs, it may result in a delay in treatment or even a change in treatment. Even if you are overweight, you can become malnourished. This is something I always make known to patients, because they feel like, oh, I can lose 30 pounds. This isn't the time to do that. So your healthcare team will help support you in those goals for your optimum care. The location of your cancer in the pancreas will impact your nutrition plan. A dietitian can provide you with your individualized nutrition plan to help meet your goals. Some patients may take something called a pancreatic enzyme, and this is taken to help with breaking down of food so that you can digest it and absorb it better. Signs that you may not be digesting or absorbing food are bloating, gas, diarrhea, maybe a light-colored stool, almost like a grayish color, and maybe a floating stool. These symptoms may result in weight loss, so it's very important that you let your healthcare team know if any of these you're experiencing any of these things. The amount of enzyme can be adjusted to meet your needs, so please reach out to your dietitian or healthcare team as soon as possible to let them know if you're experiencing these symptoms while taking the medication, because it's a very easy thing to change, and it's very normal that we make these adjustments. So don't hesitate to let us know. Blood sugar management might be part of your treatment plan. This is something that can happen for some patients, not all patients, but a dietitian can also help design a meal plan with working towards stabilizing your blood sugar levels. So maintaining your hydration is essential. Dehydration can actually amplify a lot of your symptoms like nausea, fatigue, even making you feel dizzier, have a headache. And fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, sports drinks. A general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day. Some treatments may require that you have more hydration or less, so talk with your team to understand your unique needs. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team dedicated to you and to be with you and supporting you during this journey. So please reach out to them. On that note, I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was a wonderful presentation, and I know that there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm going to just say a few words about cancer care services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. And we provide free programs and services throughout the United States. Many people access our services by calling our Hope Line, 800-813-4673. And the Hope Line is answered by, we have about 40 oncology social workers. So they take turns answering the phone. So there's no wait time for you when you call. And many people call with a specific question, like they need help with financial assistance with either copay or food insecurity. And the copayment assistance program also helps with some of the costs of chemotherapy, which can be quite high. And then also many people will call to talk with one of our social workers for support or join an online support group. And we have online support groups on every topic you can imagine, both on specific types of cancer, like pancreatic cancer, and we also have them for different age groups, so for young adults, older adults, middle-aged adults, partners, caregivers, so groups for everyone on different topics, so that those are available too. And we also have a number of publications that we have available that you can download from our website, www.cancercare.org. Or you can also access these workshops. The programs occur live, but then within a couple of days, they are a podcast that are up for at least a year, if not longer. And then you can access them. And we do provide closed caption on the podcast. So for those of you who either have some hearing impairment or like to be able to read as well, listen to the speakers, you can do that as well. So that's a thumbnail sketch of all the different services we offer. There are many more. And I think you'll be able to find all those on our website. So you'll all be able to kind of get that information. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Krista to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And so this question is for Dr. Oberstein. Are there any treatments that can reduce the size of tumors? If you could just say something about that.
The size of tumor, yes. So that's an important question. I think the answer is that when treatments are effective, many times they kill tumor cells and tumors get smaller. And so one of the ways we measure treatment efficacy is through something called response rate or actual change in size of tumors. It's not always the case that there's a correlation between the change in size and the change in a person's symptoms or their survival. So although it's an important metric, it's not the only metric, but does have an important role, especially when someone is trying to see if they could shrink a tumor and get to surgery. Chemotherapy may be effective in that setting. There's also, I didn't mention this in my part, there also may be a role for radiation therapy in that setting. It's a little bit unknown exactly who should get radiation, but there are some times where we would recommend that as part of a treatment plan.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Smaglow. If someone joins a clinical trial, do they no longer receive the normal standard of care, i.e. do they risk not being on the otherwise recommended chemotherapy?
Thank you for the question, and it's a great question. And so the way I would think about it is no. The idea behind a clinical trial is not to do therapy instead of other therapies that might be approved, but to have additional options. Some clinical trials are sort of a hybrid of chemotherapy plus the experimental drug or drug therapy. Other clinical trials are just an experimental therapy on their own. And so it's, I think, important to discuss with the provider, with your provider about, you know, what the best order of things is to do. But a trial should not be at the expense of therapies that might otherwise work. The one thing I would say is that when you're on any therapy, that's the only therapy that you're eligible for. And so if a clinical trial offers some combination of treatments, that would be the only treatment that you would be getting at that time. You would not, for example, be getting that trial therapy and then be able to get a little chemotherapy on the side. It would be instead of, not in addition to.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And that's a really important question, and thank you for addressing that. The question for Ms. Bearden, one of my main problems is gaining weight. I find myself going to the bathroom more often. Then how do I help with that? I'm on Lomtil. Whatever can I do?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's a common side effect with people who are dealing with pancreas cancer. So what I would do is keep a food log, and also I would take note of how quickly you're going to the restroom after eating. I'd also take note if your stool is light-colored or floating, if you have a lot of gas. And I would bring this to the team. I'm not sure if you're maybe on an enzyme therapy already, but that could be adjusted, or you may not be taking it to its best potential. So there's some little tweaks here and there. You're really supposed to take, if you're taking an enzyme, you're supposed to take it right when you start the meal with your first bite of food, and then really about every 10 minutes or so later. So it's like beginning, middle, and end if you are on an enzyme therapy. You may be having diarrhea for another reason, so talk with your healthcare team. There may be some other management suggestions they can provide, but be sure you understand how to take the medications that you're prescribed. I know there's a lot of medications that are given throughout your cancer therapy, but feeling confident in when to take them and how to take them will help with some of these side effects. So the weight loss could be related to that potentially, but your healthcare team is going to know best. So just, I would say, keep that record, and then how you're taking any medication that you are prescribed, like when you're taking it and how you're feeling afterwards, they may need to adjust it, but they will be able to work with you on managing your symptoms so that you can address this concern.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I have two questions for Dr. Epstein. One is about the use, of direction about use of cannabis to help with symptom management. And the other question, also with nerve pain already radiated, has had chemo, just how liberally will you prescribe narcotic pain meds? If you could answer these questions in a general way, just to give our participants information about this, I think that would be very helpful to them.
Sure, and I'll start with the use of cannabis and related products, which are increasingly being found to be helpful in some, not all situations, but some situations for symptom management, may it be pain, nausea, insomnia, anxiety, or other. There are established and helpful, sometimes helpful, treatments for those symptoms, but those treatments sometimes have side effects, and as we know more and more, cannabis, while sometimes with side effects of its own, can sometimes help with symptom management and increasingly are being found to have and thought to have generally less risk compared to their potential benefits. So while there are, state-specific and national-specific guidelines for how those are done and where people could get them, these are things that should be asked about to either the medical oncology team and or the specialty palliative care team. Regarding, I think, what was the other question about nerve pain, there was someone who was saying after chemotherapy, so I'll take it generally as well as specifically. If it's specifically after chemotherapy, which had been mentioned to be a common sequela of chemotherapy, such as from the nab-paclitaxel or more commonly a difficult one from the oxaliplatin, then that is something, as Dr. Smaglow said, needs to be very actively communicated about, and oftentimes those drugs need to be decreased in dosage, if not stopped outright, because the neuropathic or other side effects from those drugs actually, believe it or not, would have more detriment than benefit in certain circumstances. Part of that reason is because the neuropathy that results from chemotherapy agents is very often not helped with symptoms or other modalities. I agree with Dr. Smaglow talking about the promise of acupuncture in the treatment of chemotherapy-related peripheral neuropathy. However, it is sometimes not beneficial in those circumstances. So prevention is often the best treatment for neuropathy from chemotherapy. And if it's about neuropathy from pain itself, I won't go into it, but there are other medications beyond opiates that sometimes have benefit for a neuropathic type of pain from the tumor itself, not from a treatment.
Are you able to address just the off-label use of drugs? Just because the team consists of many different disciplines, you have access to quite a range of other medications that are used for one thing but actually sometimes help with something else.
Sure. The neuropathic pain, again, not from the tumor itself, not from chemotherapy and induced neuropathy, the neuropathic pain can sometimes be helped not just by opiates, some of which are particularly good for neuropathic pain, such as methadone, which is one of the opiates, but there are some non-opiate medications that can sometimes help with that, whether they are from the class of medications known as antidepressants or other type of neuropathic pain agents, not because people are depressed, but because there are side effect profiles in these medicines that can sometimes help with neuropathic pain. The neuropathy from chemotherapy, as I said, is much more difficult to have success in treating. We know that that medications, particularly the antidepressant duloxetine, has a statistically significant but only likely a clinically modest significant benefit in helping people with their chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, particularly when it's painful. The majority of neuropathy from chemotherapy is not painful. So I use duloxetine because it has a generally good side effect profile in patients, the rare patient who has a painful chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. But I try to counsel patients that unfortunately this is not, you know, likely to make the pain go away, or we hope for some type of reduction in that neuropathic pain.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've really been phenomenal. This has been an amazing program. And although we've done this program before, I have to say that the quality of this program is far superior to anything we've done in the past. And also, it's also based on the kind of questions everyone's been asking. Really such really very good, great questions. And I'm going to ask our speakers if they would provide just a takeaway from each of them, just a minute takeaway of what you'd like people to take away from the program. I'm going to start with Dr. Oberstein, then Dr. Smaglow, Dr. Epstein, and Ms. Bearden. So do you want to go first, Dr. Oberstein?
It'd be my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me on this program. It's really an honor to be here and to be with my colleagues who are great experts in this. My one takeaway, if I'm limited to one, really emphasizes that patients and their families should try to learn everything they can about their tumor, including the stage of disease, the type of, you know, subtype of pancreatic cancer, and any mutations, both germline and somatic tumor mutations. Because although today a lot of that information does not yet change therapy, we're optimistic that as time goes on that will and may expose, you know, patients to new clinical trials or new therapies. So getting more information and knowledge about your tumor is really important.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Oberstein. And Dr. Smaglow?
Thank you. So I guess, you know, philosophically, the least effective therapy for a cancer is the cancer that you have to stop receiving. And if the reason you're stopping it is because symptoms and side effects have just gotten out of control, I think that's really catastrophic, because there really are a lot of options for how we can work with an individual and find the right balance of symptomatic management and dosing of therapy, and really help, you know, our individual patients and their families understand what to expect in terms of, you know, how things will be going forward. So I would just really drive home the point of not just accepting things as an assumed status quo. An individual's patient's experience with symptoms are just that, they're individual. And so we are happy to understand, work with you, what you're experiencing, and to do whatever we can to modify what we're doing, augment what we're doing as far as symptom management goes, et cetera, so that you can stick with the therapy if it's what you want to do, and not have it be a hard decision between a really terrible quality of life in order for some prognostic benefit. So be a squeaky wheel.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Epstein.
Thanks, everyone, again, for having me. And I feel like I have my newfound kindred spirit in Dr. Smaglow, because without echoing what he said, I think my take-home message would be that patients should think about what's most important to them in their life when they're navigating any cancer diagnosis, including pancreas cancer, because, as Dr. Smaglow said, each individual needs to consider their priorities, their goals, their hopes, their concerns, and to be able to discuss that with their loved ones, and to be sure to discuss that with the oncology teams and other teams, because those teams really, really care and would benefit from that information and would hear it best from the patient and or the family members the most, so that the care teams can deliver care that is most concordant with what each individual's goals, values, preferences, and priorities are.
Excellent. And thank you so much, Dr. Epstein. And I'm so glad there's really been a really great sense of camaraderie amongst our speakers, which really, I know, makes a very big difference for our participants on the call today. So thank you so much. And Ms. Bearden, if you'd like to provide a takeaway as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just, you know, connecting with yourself during your treatment, being aware of your unique side effects and experiences, because although the healthcare team knows in general what's happening, these tidbits that you provide us in your visit are priceless, because it helps us individualize the care that we're providing to your needs. So, you know, talk about how you're taking your medications if you're uncomfortable or having these side effects. Know how to reach your healthcare team so that you can connect with them as soon as possible. Don't wait and let things continue to go. And realize that we're here for you. And so just reach out to us when you need us.
Excellent. And also, there are a few people who asked just questions. I'm just going to respond to quickly. We do have all these programs are recorded, and they become a podcast probably within about 4 days, and then they're up on our website. Now, you will be receiving from us a SurveyMonkey, but that SurveyMonkey will also include any resource any of us mentioned, and even some additional ones. So though it's an evaluation of the program, you also, don't just dismiss it. Be sure to look at the resources, because we'll have all the resources listed. So you can contact Cancer Care at our Hope Line, and you'll be getting all that information really pretty seamlessly. Also, you'll be able to visit our website as well, and we will be able to provide financial assistance and support and all kinds of services as well. So I want to thank everyone for your participation today. You've been just an amazing group of participants. I also want to thank our speakers, who've just been phenomenal. And most importantly, I don't want anyone on this call to feel that you're alone. I want you to know that you're now part of the community of support, and we're here to help you. And there are a lot of resources out there for you, and we will include other resources as well that you can contact, some that have a 24-hour call center, some that are just open during business hours. So also check with your physician, your healthcare team, as to who you can contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays, because those seem to be the times when things always people have some issues that come up. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Have a great day.